Welcome to Behind the Game, the Kids in the Game official podcast, where we cover the intersection of youth development, sports, education, and technology in the New York City landscape.
Welcome, everybody, to Behind the Game, Kids in the Game's official podcast. This is Paul O'Connor. On episode 15, we are joined by Drew Chaffetz. He is the co-founder and CEO of Love Football. Love Football is a nonprofit organization that engages and mobilizes communities to create, reclaim, and redefine their own soccer spaces as sustainable platforms for social change. It's an awesome, awesome episode. Give it a listen now. All right, we are now joined by Drew Chaffetz. He is the co-founder and CEO of Love Football. Drew, thank you for coming. Appreciate you being here and taking time on this gloomy Friday. Welcome.
Great to be here, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so let's dive right in. Easiest question that you'll be faced with all afternoon is, what is Love Football?
What is Love Football? So Love Football is a nonprofit organization. We began in 2006, and we have a simple mission, which is to ensure every kid has a safe place to fulfill their passion for soccer. You can extend that idea a bit to sports generally, and in the depth of our brand, what we really stand for is self-expression for social change. You know, the right to sport, art, music, dance. There's a dot in our name, love.football, and it's meant to be the connection globally through sport, you know, across languages and cultures. That is a community, globally speaking, and that is a universal language, of course. But it's also a pivot point. You know, art, music, dance also has that universal appeal and connects humans fundamentally. And we exist to ensure kids have that most basic opportunity to play the game.
That's awesome. We're going to dive into a lot of the details about it, but how did you yourself get here? What is your story?
Well, I am a DC born and raised kid. I was fortunate to have some very passionate, traveler-oriented parents that from super early age took my sister and I around the world. I'd been to six continents by the time I was 12, which is a pretty, you know, awesome and unique chance.
That's wild.
You know, pretty grateful for that. And but at the same time, I happened to be, you know, since before I could walk, or I should say remember, I loved soccer. I just passionate about the ball and gravitated towards the game. And so when I was in all these countries around the world, you know, and you know, my parents kind of dug in a little bit. Like, we went to favelas in Rio, and we were like basically hitchhiking in Kenya, and, you know, really kind of off the grid places. And in all these places, you know, kids were playing the game that I loved. And so, you know, I had this unique opportunity to be kind of in these places in the first place, but have this tool that allowed me to like somewhat actively participate and connect with people with polar opposite realities, you know, kids my age, but you know, different life, you know, circumstance. But through the game, we could see that, you know, there was something fundamentally the same about us. And so that had a big part of my upbringing. That's kind of part one of the story. Part two is that I was studying abroad in Barcelona in 2005, and I I had some time free at the end of my semester abroad, went down to Morocco, and came across some kids in this back alleyway. It's kind of a serendipitous story, but these kids playing in this dangerous spot, in short. And, you know, if you take a look at the Love Football logo, it embraces imperfection, actually. You know, it's one of the beauties of soccer is that, and strengths is how simple it is, and the fact that the game can be played, you know, pretty much anywhere. But this was the first time that I'd seen a situation where, like, kids actually were playing this game in danger. And, you know, I was 23 at the time, and I was like, there's something about me, you know, really planted a seed of a question more than anything. I was like, you know, do kids face challenges playing the world's great game, you know? Is that a thing? So that is what born the idea for Love Football. And then part three of the story is I played soccer in college. I went to Dickinson in Pennsylvania, D3 school, and then played for the University of Colorado. They only had a club team at the time. That's why I played there as well. But the captain of our team at Dickinson and I were very close friends, and we co-founded Love Football together and piloted the idea in Guatemala, which I can also go into depth about.
No, so, that's actually a perfect, yeah. I mean, you already answered that. I was going to ask kind of the motivation behind it.
Yeah.
A lot of people have ideas every day.
Yeah.
So you guys have this idea in college, and I mean, you're 19, 20, 21, right around there.
Yeah.
What is step one? I mean, especially you have an idea that isn't in the States. So what is legitimately step one to even exploring this?
Well, you know, as I kind of mentioned, like, you know, for me, this was something that was deep into my personal history and experience, and I felt like it resonated with me on a very deep level. And it really, that step one was answering that question, you know, do kids face challenges playing soccer? And, you know, and that meant, like, so Alfredo and I, the co-founder, we went to Guatemala on this exploratory venture with that question in mind, and we've fundraised like $600 at a bar with amongst our friends, and had a, you know, round trip ticket and a half to go down to Guatemala, and otherwise we were doing this all on our own. And you know, we were, you know, young and like determined and passionate, and it was an adventure. Cool is that, you know, I can get super cheesy here, but you know, Paulo Coelho's quotes of, you know, when you follow your heart, the universe conspires, you know, to assist you.
Yeah,
and
on your behalf, yeah.
On some level, I think that happened a bit. You know, we were, you know, knocking on every door, and people helped us, and you know, we identified a few pilot communities where we felt like kids didn't have a place to play. We learned a lot about this challenge because we wanted to like speak about it and you know, be able to document and show people why. And I think that was the biggest part one is, you know, what is your why, and you know, how do you know that it's a real thing? And so that was part one, and then part two is raising money.
I was ready for that.
So, yeah.
Yep. And it's again, you're a natural but perfect transition, is how are you guys funded? So first of all, how long did you guys stay down there?
So we were down there for 7 months.
Okay.
And
wow.
Well, the first time the exploratory venture around that question was 3 weeks.
Okay.
And that's when we were running around like crazy. Came back to the US, raised about $30,000. This was, I think...
Was this family, friends? Was it like GoFundMe raise money?
Friends,
or?
Family, fools is
Got
the three F's. Yeah,
we
it's
know
how you begin. And that's how we began. And you know, yeah, we were lucky. You know, this was pre-Kickstarter days through a couple of fundraisers. We're in our...
And this is 06, 07?
06, 07.
Okay.
Yeah, this was 07 at this point. And, you know, we had firepower. We had visited these communities that people were asking these questions to. We were saying like, this is a real need. This is why we would, you know, be behind it with you. And so we came back with that, and you know, we had energy and with our why, right? And so raised about 30, went back to Guatemala. We're there for 7 months. Did a pilot in our first community. And we did three projects during those 7 months. And that's when we really got into the how part of the story, which, you know, is kind of on equal level of importance to our why.
And I definitely want to know about the how. So when you say, what does it mean when you say three projects?
Right. So, you know, when I say I mean it like a sports facility project.
Got it.
And these were all like, at the time, these were cement futsal courts. You know, super simple, durable, you know, culturally appropriate in Guatemala. And that actually wasn't our initial idea. Originally, we were going to be even more simple, like dirt pitches. But luckily, through failure and determination, we, you know, learned there's a heavy rainy season in Guatemala, and the dirt concept we had kind of wasn't doing so well. And spoke with the community again and shifted to this cement futsal court model, which is what we did for all nine projects that we did in Guatemala over the course of the following 5 years. But we've moved beyond that initial model as well.
And so who do you have to talk to in the community? And I'm going to get to, you know, your concept around community-driven based products or projects, I'm sorry. But who's step one? I mean, are you going to the government? Are you going directly to the kids? Are you going to parents and all the above? Who did you have to talk to?
Yeah, so we were introduced to these communities, so we needed a bridge in. You know, we weren't kind of showing up on our own. Through partners, we worked with the Department of Physical Education in Guatemala. They were one of the groups that helped us out when we really didn't have much to demonstrate, but, you know, seemed determined. And so, you know, we really came with questions, and to this day, you know, we're kind of questions oriented, you know, about, you know, is this a real need? You know, do kids face challenges playing here? If there's desire for a sports-based project, would you, you know, what kind of project are we talking about? How can we do this here? Who's the landowner? But to your question about community-driven sports spaces, that's really what distinguishes the way that we work, and that's our how, which is that these are completely community-driven from our first step in the community, you know, and it begins with those questions, right? You know, the answer to how you realize a sports facility project in Bangalore, India, is going to be different from, you know, Rio de Janeiro and Arusha, Tanzania. And
what are some of the major differences? Is it just who you talk to or who's responsible? What are some of the big ones?
So I think that, you know, and this is kind of deep in our ethos and in our brand, is like what's the biggest factor is actually what's the same, right? Which is that in every community you're going to find mothers, fathers, teachers, you know, people who want to see their kids in a healthy place, you know, having a place to play, understand the value of sports in the lives of youth and in a community, and we tap into that. And so we often are working with local nonprofits, broad range of community stakeholders, and engaging them kind of holistically around a sports facility project, from the, you know, the planning stage to the organizing the community to the actual building of the facility. So on average, we have over 2,000 hours of volunteer community service per project from, you know, I think over 20 community groups. So you're really talking about a community coming together around a unified mission. So that's what's the same. In answer to what's different, you know, there's, you know, different bureaucracy. There's different sports types of sports spaces. You know, there's different religions. There's different, you know, structures to decision making. You know, sometimes it's, you know, there's a local, you know, group in a small village that can make a decision about how to use space. Sometimes, as we learned in Philadelphia, it's a little bit more complicated than that. You know, got to get on the, you know, on the board resolution for the school district. So, you know, but that again comes back to the importance of asking questions, and there are locals in every community that can help you find those answers. And so we're critically dependent on the communities that we work with. That's what makes a low football project a low football project, is that it can't be realized without the community taking a stand.
How many countries are you in right now?
So we have just completed, on Monday we will complete it's 11th project this year. And that will be in 9 countries this year. Total, we've been in, I believe, 12 countries. So mainly in Latin America. You know, Brazil is one of our major hubs for our team, where we actually, half of our staff live there. It's a decent-sized team in Mexico, in Mexico City. We also are growing a team now here in the United States. You know, Monday we're inaugurating a project in Tanzania, the one I referenced, and you know, Australia, India, Egypt.
How are the projects sourced now? Are people starting to find out about you and reaching out?
Yeah, certainly. I mean,
no,
you know,
it's just getting busier.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, I mean, I just had a call actually with a nonprofit from Guatemala that is interested in doing a series of sports based projects. And you know, there's always a demand side of for these projects, and you know, we really actually have a big goal. You know, we say we're mission simple, vision vast. You know, simple mission: every kid has a safe place for this game. Vision vast: every kid has a safe place for this game. And so, you know, how do we get there? And you know, we're doing 11 projects a year, which is actually a ton for us. But you know, we're asking big questions about our growth strategy and how we can expand faster. And I'm trying to remember what your original question is so I can weave back to it.
It was really just like, now how are the projects getting sourced? And like, are you going to different countries and offering like you were kind of like the bootstrap way back in the day? Or is it now like, hey, we heard about them, reach out? And it's probably a mix, I guess.
It's definitely a mix. You know, groups come to us. And but I think the point that I was trying to get to is that, you know, we are dependent on, we're a nonprofit, we're dependent on funds to execute these projects. Most of our projects have been through corporate funders. We've done most projects with ESPN has been one of our biggest funders. We did a number with Coke earlier on in our history. But you know, FedEx, Under Armour, Unilever, Manchester City is one of our bigger sponsors.
That's awesome.
We have a foundation that has given us a really wonderful grant to do 5 projects that we just finished our 4th in the Dominican Republic, the Pincus Family Foundation. They're a really incredible partner. And so because of dependency on funds from outside groups, we, you know, to some degree, we try to align our social mission with the interests of these funders. And sometimes the interests are, you know, like with the Pincus Family Foundation, really, you know, they've got certain countries they care about and are maybe already doing social work, and this is a great fit. But in other cases with corporate sponsors, they might have strategic interests in a certain place, and therefore we kind of find a balance between, you know, making sure we're in the right communities, but at the same time, you know, doing a project in a place that they can get some value out of. So in a sense, there's an element of social enterprise in what we do. You know, we're not just creating safe spaces, but we're trying to do it in places with our sponsors in ways that create value for them. So, you know, PR, engaging employees in build days. You know, building relationships with communities that they care about, you know, are some of the key ways.
What are the, and I gotta imagine it's different based on each one, but what would be a good range of like all in costs for one of these projects?
Yeah. So, costs, and I wanna partially finish answering your last question, because I know I've been kind of going in circles here a little bit, but we exist in a sector of sport for social development. You know, there are from totally grassroots organizations to huge nonprofits that are reaching millions of kids. There are lots of groups around the world that recognize the power of sport to educate kids on all types of themes, you know, whether it's, you know, job training or conflict resolution or health education or gender equality. You know, sport is a mechanism to educate people about these things. And we kind of call those are like programs most often, and they're implemented by often community-based nonprofits. We have a very different model. We're implementing the infrastructure. We're not doing the programs. We specialize in something that all programs need is a place. Mm-hmm. We can actually help program these nonprofits expand their programs to new communities through an infrastructure intervention. And so that's one of the main ways that we identify locations for projects is through this global network of sport for development nonprofits that are already using sport for social change. So to answer your funding question, we often package those pieces together. So we were talking about an infrastructure, community-driven infrastructure project with Love Football, in partnership with an organization that's going to run programs, you know, doing job training for kids long term in that community.
Got it. I'm telling you what, man. I think you're the best guest we've ever had, because right into the next question is like, what happens when you leave, and how is it sustainable?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It is with the community partners that.
That's one of the big pieces, and you know, sustainability is a tough tough word in general, I think. And you know, what I like to say is we increase our chances of sustainability because, you know, our method is about communities taking ownership over this project process, and therefore the resulting asset that they've created. And, you know, we work deeply with the community to do that. You know, we've project captains in every project that cover all different key needs of a sports facility project, and they kind of evolve into, we call it a neighbors network that, you know, decides on bylaws of the field and the calendar, which, you know, some of our projects have like 40 scheduled events, pitches, you know, 40 scheduled events per week, and, you know, Zumba classes and cinema screenings, and you know, how can you make that's why the importance of the community engagement and all these different groups. Like, this is a shared community tool. You know, how can you make it super dynamic and powerful? And so that is a big piece of the sustainability, is, you know, creating a sustainability plan that's locally tailored. That's something that's different in every community. In a rural village, you don't have the same type of revenue generation potential that you might have in a city, where you can do more of like a you know, pay to play league or something. So every situation is different, and we work with the community to leverage the reality that they're in.
So you just launched two projects in Philadelphia, first two projects in the States, correct?
That's right.
Talk about those. Why Philly?
Why Philly? Well, this was actually with our partner, the Pincus Family Foundation, and they have done a lot of work in Philly. They're actually Philly-based, and a lot of their history is from there. They support a lot of other work there. So, you know, we could leverage some of the contacts that they had in trying to, really for us, this was a pilot to introduce this methodology that we've developed over 13 years of engaging communities around sports-based projects in a U.S. context. And so we did one project in North Philly, one in Southwest. You know, it's interesting because, like, I actually didn't, when we began La Football, the U.S. was not high on the list of priorities. You know, we were more focused on, you know, places that had, like, what I viewed as profound poverty and soccer passionate culture, and that where those correlations were strongest is where we felt like we likely belonged most, and U.S. wasn't as high on that correlation. And so but, you know, I've actually spent more time in places like, you know, West End of Atlanta and, you know, parts of Baltimore, and you know, seeing that, you know, there really is a disconnect between communities and public spaces in certain parts of our country, and that is, you know, a lifeline. You know, that's what we believe in fundamentally, is that, you know, sport is a you know, it's a fundamental human need. It's an example of self-expression I meant, and for some kids that is a way to keep them on a positive track in life, and so to not have safe spaces in your neighborhood that you can walk to and play is really, like, fundamentally wrong. You know, like, we need to do better than that as humans. And so that's what I began to see in the U.S. and why we started to build interest here, is that, you know, there often was sometimes sports spaces, but communities had lost kind of an emotional connection to them, and that's really what we specialize in. It's not just creating, you know, a physical place to play, but, you know, an emotional, you know, symbol of pride of the community, something that they've really done with their own hands. And you know, these two projects in Philly, like, these communities rallied. Like, you know, we found that point I made about the same. Like, there were those people in these communities ready to stand up and take action. So that was a really special thing to see, is our you know, experience abroad take hold in the U.S. for the first time.
So this may be a tough one. but obviously we're based here in New York. We do programming everywhere, in hallways, classrooms.
Yeah, I imagine.
Gyms are great when we can get them.
Yeah.
Outdoor spaces are normally parking lots. So how can we, the community, effectively create more spaces that you're talking about. Not just another field, not another court. Yep. There's basketball court. There's a crazy stat, and I'm going to butcher it, but someone can Google it afterwards. It's basically like you're never more than like 1 mile away from a basketball court.
Really?
In New York City.
Interesting, yeah.
Which is insanity.
Yeah.
But to what you're talking about, most of the courts are run down. Yep. They don't even have nets. They're not... They're not exactly inspiring hope and change in these courts. And so how can we in New York come together and maybe that's your next city?
Yeah.
That would be great.
That would. we're interested. I mean, you know, we still want to operate where our sweet spot is best, and we're very much learning that here in the U.S. I think that, you know, to your point, I mean, there in every neighborhood across this city, you know, there are people who this idea I think would resonate with, and so, you know, how can we engage them collectively in like putting some real energy into these spaces and making them, you know, points of pride and, you know, reclaiming them. You know, we say we partner with communities to create, reclaim, and redefine sports spaces. You know, you're looking for programming, and there might be, you know, a location that, you know, a dilapidated tennis court or, you know, some spot that, like, you know, maybe you implement programs there sometimes, but, you know, could it be like a real platform for you to have a relationship with the community and that you guys are on the same page about how we're going to maintain this space? And that's something that's a little bit unique to our experience of working in the U.S. is that I think a lot of municipalities aren't used to the idea of depending on people in, you know, in those communities to take ownership and, you know, maintain and manage a sports space. Like,
yep.
And they'd rather not cede, you know, the power to a group they don't know. And so that's, you know, I could easily criticize it, but I'm not necessarily criticizing that. Like, I think that's evolved for the reasons it has and sometimes not good reasons. But, you know, I think here it'd be more of a political thing of like, how do you change higher up opinions about how communities can engage with sports spaces? And that's something that we're, you know, still kind of learning here, having worked in more informal places largely throughout the world.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Are there any other organizations similar to you that are doing this work?
Yeah, there are. I mean, there are, you know, other nonprofits that are building sports spaces around the world, and you know in the U.S. for example, there's the U.S. Soccer Foundation, which you know, has a really big dream of building 1,000 mini pitches across the U.S. And you know, over the past, you know, 10 or so years, the U.S. soccer world has really caught on to the idea, you know, this game doesn't have to be played on big full-size, mm-hmm. you know, grass soccer fields or even turf. And, you know, there's kind of a mini pitch revolution happening. And that, I think that's really exciting. It's a big goal that they have. You know, we take a very, you know, different approach from like a community engagement perspective to sports spaces. But, you know, I think that, and that's really what distinguishes Love Football in contrast to a lot of other groups that do sports-based projects, is our critical focus on you know, creating that precedent of community-driven development from the first second you enter a community. So, yeah, I mean, there's a handful of others. Johan Cruyff Foundation out of the Netherlands, I believe, and you know, there are other, certainly, you know, as I mentioned, a lot of sport for development nonprofits, and a lot of them have started innovating around sports spaces because, as you were mentioning, you're doing programs and you're looking constantly for places, right?
Yeah.
And so a lot of these community-based groups are starting to innovate. And so an excellent example is Soccer in the Streets, mm-hmm. in Atlanta. They created this MARTA, you know, station soccer
yep.
concept
yep.
and are now building pitches all across Atlanta. on metro lines. It's a true innovation. They've gotten global recognition for it, and that's an awesome example of the that need that these community-based organizations have. And Street Soccer USA has built a bunch of pitches, and which is a partner of ours. And so we have 13 years under our belt of this community engagement method, and like that's what we want to contribute to all these organizations, so that you're not just building the physical space, but engaging community to have an even deeper role in the idea of sport for development.
Switching gears a little bit, you touched on it briefly, but what does, and again, it's an unanswerable question, it's tough, but what does the states have to do, what do we have to do differently to compete on the world stage soccer-wise, and or will we ever compete on the world stage soccer-wise?
Yeah.
You're kind of the perfect. You see soccer all over the world.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know if we'll ever get over football. NFL is just the biggest thing for us right now.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Good luck.
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't have a perfect answer certainly, but my overarching view about soccer in the U.S. is a long game. People kind of. We're the United States of America, and we think we can compete globally in an instant. But this really is, an exceptional sport that we really do have to compete on a global scale with countries that have been doing this for many decades and generations. And like when I think about the growth of the game here, I'm 37 years old. I don't have kids yet, but a lot of my friends have kids there growing up, and I consider the 40 and younger, to my age generation to have been really the first widespread generation of soccer players in our country. And most people my age grew up playing the game on some level. It was pretty common. And and so our kids are the first generation in the history of our country that had parents that played on a widespread level. And so, when most kids our age were playing as kids, our parents said, kick the ball, because like that's what they knew how to say. But like, our generation in theory knows a little bit more than that. And I think that matters. College soccer and the challenges to get in urban and low income environments, get the game in, and the challenges with youth soccer in America, which has some deeply ingrained obstacles that are a shame. And, that's definitely something to talk about. But I think that, I'm okay with us taking time. I think if you look at MLS today versus 10 years ago, it's completely different. It takes time. And I think,
maybe our kids' kids that win.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm okay with that. Yeah. I think that's right. That's the way it should be. But most importantly, I think the projection is largely in the right direction. More kids are playing. We're trying to figure out how to get pitches in the inner city. We're trying to figure out how to engage communities. We're trying to make sure that kids, once they've had a chance to play, can actually find out there's a pathway to them playing competitive soccer, rather than having to, have a, mother with a minivan situation, which isn't what everyone has. So it's definitely complicated. There's a lot of hurdles to go, but I believe we're moving in the right direction with time.
Awesome. Yeah. You did a great job answering it, man. That was good. all right. Last question. We'll get you out of here. And it doesn't necessarily need to be in New York City, since you've traveled, I think, literally everywhere in the world. But you can start with New York City. Favorite slice of pizza in New York. And if it is somewhere else, then it can be somewhere else.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm going to have to go directly to my hometown.
All right.
And say that Vache Pizza on Connecticut Avenue
Nice. We're both in Connecticut. We like that. Connecticut. All right. Vache Pizza.
Vache.
In D.C.
In D.C.
Okay.
Is the
where,
best.
What area of D.C.? Is that like the Georgetown area? Is that
that's the, like, I think that's Woodley Park or Cleveland Park, technically. It's right in that area, northwest.
I think that's our only second city. We asked this question to Rick Nadeau, who works at MSG, and he gave us a Boston spot.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So it's our second... Third city, actually. We've got New York, Boston, and D.C. now. All right. So that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Is it slice or you got to get a pie?
Yes, so you can get a slice, get a pie, just this beautiful tomato sauce.
All right.
Like a little bit of cheese on the underside. But, oh, man, that there's
that's
nothing.
The
that they had love in there. There was something special going.
All right.
Yeah.
So community.
Yeah, community.
Pizza.
Exactly. same thought was in my mind.
That was it. All right, before we get out of here, where can everybody find you? Website, social, all that stuff.
So we're all over. Love Football. It's the Spanish spelling FUTBOL .org. And, you know, we're on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Love Football, _ US for Instagram, I think. And, reach out to us. You know, if you're passionate about the game, you know, we believe there's no way to give back more directly than creating the opportunity to play it. So,
yep,
thanks so much, Paul, for this.
Yeah, thanks for coming, man. We really appreciate it. Best of luck, with the next couple projects. We'll be watching.
Cheers, man. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Behind the Game. Make sure to subscribe in the iTunes store and be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram @KidsInTheGameNY and Facebook @KidsInTheGameNYC.